The Debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to The Debate. I'm Behruz Najafi. Seeing the beatings, vandalism, and detentions in Colombia these days, human rights groups have condemned the police's heavy-handed tactics against rallyers. It's said that 19 civilians have lost their lives and over 800 people have been wounded. The rallies are still underway, despite the government's announcement of reviewing a tax reform package that has sparked the protests. It seems that the demonstrations are not going to stop as people and unions are raising more demands. So what's next in Colombia? Will the Duque administration stop the crackdown and instead heed the people's demands? Okay, to discuss those questions, I'm joined by our guests in tonight's debate show. We'll have journalists with the Behind the Headlines, Dan Cohen, who's joining us out of Washington, D.C., and also journalists and political analysts, Ali Vargas from Cochabamba in Bolivia. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Dan first. The concession by Duque's government, Dan, to backpedal on a proposed tax reform has done little to calm the protesters' anger. Why is that?
Well, Duque's announcement was little more than an attempt to trick the population into stopping the protests. When Duque announced that he would withdraw it, he also said that he would announce another proposal in the next few days, and that it was absolutely necessary. And this trick failed. The protests have only grown, and the demands have continued to add up, because Colombia is a country in absolute crisis, where 43% of the population is in poverty, and 15% is in extreme poverty, and the government is attempting to force these tax reforms of the public, and it's being rejected.
Okay, Ali, popular anger goes beyond the tax reform, and protesters are demanding much more than the withdrawal of the tax reforms only. So what are the other things that the protesters ask him for?
Well, Colombia is going through a very similar crisis to another South American country, Peru, and that is that Colombia, historically and currently, of course, has a free market economic model that delivered growth for the 1% and crumbs for the vast majority of people. And sort of a mix of propaganda, repression has managed to keep sort of social unrest at bay, or at least repress it when it does come out. However, the pandemic has seen that social setup, that system, really crumble, because, and I think the tax reform that they're trying to push through is a symbol of that, because with the pandemic and with the lockdown having destroyed the country's tax base, as businesses close down, people fall out of formal employment. So their solution, now that the government doesn't have enough revenue, is to tax the general population, raise taxes on the general population. Mm-hmm. And they have to do this because Colombia is a country that doesn't have big state industries that can provide it with revenue, to have the funds that it needs to satisfy basic demands of ordinary people, particularly at a time like this. So we've seen people lose faith in the system that Colombia has had for decades under, and has maintained with an iron fist. So people's demands are against inequality, are against the narco-violence that emanates from the states and from pro-state paramilitary groups. That's been a tactic that, used to repress social protests for a long time, and people finally had enough. So it's a general uprising. It's not about one policy. This policy was, of course, the trigger for the reasons I explained, but this is a much wider rebellion.
Okay. Now, Dan, as you may know, Colombia is one of the countries with the largest debts in the world. And how is this affecting its domestic politics and the pressure that the government is facing in order to balance its finances?
Well, there's no doubt that the Colombian government is beholden to international capital and the neoliberal economic system. And this tax reform is essentially to please international capital. So investors see Colombia as a sort of stable market. Now, that stability comes at the price of stability and security for working class, for middle class, for poor people. So, you know, this constant instability that that Colombians suffer, well, the government has tried to kind of keep a lid on it, as Ali explained, and has been pretty successful for a long time, but attempting to force, you know, this new tax reform, this increase in taxes on the country has backfired massively. And, you know, I think the government is, it has no answer other than to use brute force to kill protesters. It's not even clear how many protesters have been killed at this point. I actually spoke to a journalist, Laura Sofia Mejia, about a press agency in Pereira, Colombia today, who told me that the highest levels of the government have given an order for the hospitals to not report the number of deaths and injuries. So it's only up to the journalists to go through the hospitals and the emergency rooms and count how many deaths there have been. So there's no real count, and I think it's safe to assume that it's much higher than the 19 or 20 that have been reported so far. So Colombia is in absolute crisis purely because of the financial system that its ruling class uses.
Now, let me ask you this. People have concerns about police violence and also human rights situation. So how serious are these concerns?
Well, it's extremely serious. Colombia is one of the most violent countries in the Americas, and the massacres that just taken place in the city of Cali is the 35th massacre of this year, of 2021. The vast majority of massacres that take place on a weekly basis in Colombia, on a more than weekly basis, predominantly take place in rural areas against union leaders, rural workers, leaders, indigenous leaders, ex-FARC combatants. So the violence has been ongoing and permanent. I mean, just last year, 2020, there was over 90 massacres. So, you know, Colombia is looking on course to at least match the level of violence that the country saw last year. And it's something that's obviously not reported on in international media in any systematic way. And even now, we see the same thing. We see Latin America correspondents for the big newspapers be completely silent on this issue, including the South America bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, someone who lives in Colombia and has not written any articles about it. He hasn't even posted anything on Twitter about it, something that's taking place in his own country, because this is something that's severely embarrassing for a key U.S. ally. And Colombia is a key U.S. ally for a number of reasons, as the largest number of U.S. military bases in the region, in South America. And it's a key player in destabilizing other countries, destabilizing, for example, Venezuela, reinforcing the U.S. attacks on Venezuela. So I think these are all things that we have to take together. And when, you know, the United States is not going to let one of their key allies go quietly. I think that while we have silence at the moment, we may see a propaganda machine kicking in to try and defend the current government and its human rights violations.
Dan, let's now take a look at Duque's presidency and his performance. Critics are saying that his presidency is marked by incompetence, and also some others are saying that also neglecting the voices of dissent. How would you size up his performance as president?
I think those are very fair opinions of the Duque government. I mean, since day one, he's been unpopular, incompetent, as you said, and basically a puppet of the kingmaker politician in Colombia, former President Álvaro Uribe, who is, the U.S. has known for many years, is essentially a drug trafficker. And actually, Duque's presidency was bought and paid for by drug traffickers themselves. There was a major scandal that was completely ignored in the U.S. press called Ñeñe Política, in which a powerful drug trafficker named Yenye Hernandez was found to be buying votes for Iván Duque, and this was ordered by Álvaro Uribe, the former president and top U.S. ally. So it's more than incompetence. This is a complete narco state. It's been that way for decades, and under the presidency of first Álvaro Uribe and now Iván Duque, the power of the drug trafficking cartels, as well as the below board and the above board international cartels, have complete power. And so, they're not going to give that up without an extreme bloodbath, and that's what we're seeing today.
Now, Ollie, let's take a look back. I want you to please bring us up to speed about the developments that Colombia has experienced after the peace deal in 2016. And, that ended 50 years of fighting between the FARC rebel group and the government. So what is the security situation like in the country 5 years after this deal?
But yeah, that's right. The 2016 peace accords ended the longest civil war in human history. But I think for a lot of people, that civil war is still ongoing. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there's massacres on two to three massacres every week in Colombia, predominantly in rural areas where there used to be FARC insurgencies. And even though the FARC, now they are called the Communist Party, even though they handed in their weapons, they agreed to relinquish the territory they held, and they agreed to enter formal politics as a peaceful political group committed to an electoral path towards social change that they demand. Despite all of those steps taken by one side of those who signed the peace deal, the FARC, the armed insurgency, that hasn't been respected by the state nor the paramilitary groups that often fight alongside them. So that state, the military, these paramilitary groups, they continue to assassinate, ex-FARC combatants, people who handed in their weapons, and people whose names are on those 2016 peace accords. So for those people, for the hundreds of people who signed that peace treaty but have since been killed in that time, the civil war certainly didn't end for them. And of course, there's a wider war against the population. The wider population is being waged now. Now that we have blood running through the streets of urban areas, normally restricted to the rural areas of the country. So it's all coming to a crisis point, and precisely because of the economic issue that I mentioned at the beginning. So countries, for example, like Bolivia, that have large nationalized industries that provide most of the government revenue that the state uses to pay for its functions, Colombia doesn't have that. Colombia has a free market model. So when the tax base collapses during lockdown, if they don't have big state assets like countries like Bolivia have? So it's a problem of a wider economic free market model that wasn't built to sustain the sorts of blows that the pandemic has dealt the country. And it's the same immediate cause of the internal political crisis in Peru. The system that was raised and that shown up as an example of democratic neoliberalism crumpled upon impact when the pandemic hit, and the state and the free market model was exposed to something that wasn't able to take these blows, wasn't able to provide for ordinary people that suffered economically, and has left the state without the resources to rebuild the economy.
Dan, as you know, protesters are also angry at the lack of a social safety net during the pandemic. So what has been the impact of the pandemic on Colombia's economy, and how would you evaluate the government's response to the pandemic's economic and social impacts?
Well, even prior to the pandemic, Colombia was in a terrible situation financially with large swaths of the country in poverty and also in extreme poverty. And as Ollie explained so clearly, the pandemic has only exacerbated these problems. as I said before, the poverty is now at 43% of the country. It's nearly half of the people are impoverished, and 15% are in extreme poverty. People are not able to buy basic foods. They don't have their basic needs met. They can't eat. They can't buy medicine. You know, so this has come to a breaking point now, and the pandemic has been completely mismanaged in the most extreme way. I see New York Times articles criticizing Venezuela for its handling of the pandemic when Colombia has been multitudes worse. There are millions and millions of cases of COVID-19 in Colombia, and that's never really touched on in mainstream media in the U.S. It's always about Venezuela, as with all other issues. So Colombia has been, mismanaged is an understatement. It's been so severe. It has made this kind of reckoning inevitable. And, you know, sadly, now the government, after mismanaging the economy and the pandemic in such a terrible way, has now decided that it will murder basically anyone who rises up against it.
Ollie, the way that the government has handled the protests has drawn the ire of both the Colombian people and the international community and rights organizations. They're all calling for an end to this crackdown. And some believe that police reform is a must. Let's have your opinion on that.
Well, the entire international community hasn't come together to condemn this sort of violence. The notable people who have been notably silent include the Organization of American States and their secretary, Luis Almagro, someone who hold conferences, events on an almost weekly basis about Venezuela or Nicaragua or some other country. There's been silence from the United States, of course. The United States wasn't so silent when Bolivia arrested former dictator Henry Añez, but they have been a lot more silent when it comes to the executions in the streets of the urban Colombia. Also notable, as I mentioned earlier, notable in their silence has been the international media. Western correspondents working for outlets such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, have also been extremely silent about what's going on. So those, it's from those sectors, the sorts of sectors that the Colombian middle and upper class depend on for their own power, it's those sectors that have been silent about this and have refused to join the chorus of condemnation about what's going on in Colombia. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this develops, because the protests are not going away. The anger that people have is about structural reasons, so I don't think one move or another policy change is going to quell that. So if we see more repression, it would be interesting to see if more international actors decide to express solidarity with the Colombian people who are living a moment of extreme authoritarianism right across the country, the cities completely militarized, and the ongoing violence in the country's rural areas.
Now, Dan, the government insists that a tax reform is needed to stabilize the country already ravaged by the pandemic, but middle-class people are complaining that the reform pressures them and favors the rich only. Let's have your comment.
Well, the government has really put itself in a difficult position because it's completely beholden to international capital. It's in quite a bit of debt. And so in order to keep international capital investors happy, it essentially does have to do this. And so the government has just put itself in this position where it's essentially has to force this tax reform down the throats of the Colombian people, and the Colombian people simply can't take it. The poverty is already too extreme. They're asking far too much. A 19% increase, I believe, on public transportation. It's just too much for people, and so now it's playing out in the streets where it's this contradiction these are just two incompatible forces, and so unless the government changes its policy or finds another way to you know satisfy these investors, then it's hard to see how this resolves. So,
okay. All right, now Ali, what about the U.S.? It was mentioned that U.S. Is an ally. So there have been no reaction regarding all this crackdown on people's demands and the government's heavy-handed tactics against them.
No, and particularly people like Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is someone who's normally so quick to condemn Latin American countries who don't toe the line of the U.S. Yeah, as I said earlier, there has been a general silence from the most powerful sectors that helped prop up the current Colombian regime. And Colombia is a country as well that produces well over 90% of the cocaine that reaches the United States, Peru producing most of the rest. And yet we see communiques all the time on a monthly basis from Secretary of State Antony Blinken and from the institution.
Oh, it looks like we have a problem with that. One quick question, Dan. What's the way out of this situation in Colombia? Cabinet reshuffle, national dialogue, or what? 30 seconds, please.
Without the government fully withdrawing this tax proposal, there's no way that these protests will die down. As we said at the beginning of the segment, the demands have only added, and there are so many issues that have been piled on top of the government is not only intentionally basically attack all sectors of the country. So it's really hard to see how Duque comes out of this, and we could even see the downfall of Duque.
Okay. All right, and then we'll come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank our guests. We had journalists from the Behind the Headlines, Dan Cohen from Washington, D.C., and journalist and political analyst Oli Vargas, who joined us from Cochabamba in Bolivia.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khakdaman.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Hello and welcome to our program. Thank God for giving us another opportunity talk about Ahkam in Month of Ramadan. This episode, I'm going to talk about pregnant women and some of the matters around them which are needed to know in Month of Ramadan. First, about those women who are in the last weeks of their pregnancy and it is very near for them to give birth. Now, in the last weeks, because it is critical, it is very a mode and it's a very situation that needs a lot of attention, and the woman in that situation is very fragile. They need to care a lot about themselves, especially about the food that they eat and about the things that happen to them. Now, especially in the month of Ramadan, because fasting is obligatory for women that are pregnant, if fasting is very harmful for them or it is very harmful for the child that they are bearing, they should not fast, and they cannot fast. Even if they fast, it is not valid, meaning after the month of Ramadan, they should compensate for it, they should fast again, which we called it qada previously. So if it's no dangerous, if it's harmful, if it any way hurts you or the child that you are bearing, then there is no fasting for you, all right? You should not fast in the month of Ramadan, but after the month of Ramadan, you should compensate for it. When we say that you should not fast or there is no fasting for you, there is no responsibility, we mean in the month of Ramadan, because you are pregnant in this month, and after the month, your excuse is gone, so you should start to fast again. If it was harmful for the child, there is no qada for it. But if it was harmful for you, for the woman, it means that qada also is necessary. It means giving food to, you know, poor people. We talked about that before. Now, moving on to the women who are breastfeeding, right? Breastfeeding the child. Again, breastfeeding is a period that needs a lot of taking care, needs a lot of attention. And the things that, enter the body as the food, you know, the thing that they have is very important. So not eating or eating less or eating more than needed or eating in a bad situation or, anything about this eating thing, their meal, seems very important because it affects the milk. And we are going to talk about the milk here because they are breastfeeding. If it is dangerous for the milk and harmful for the breastfeeding process, or no, the milk is all right, but the mother is going to have a painful time and the mother is going to be endangered in any way, in peril. Again, they should not fast after the month of Ramadan when they felt well again after the pregnancy and, you know, the time passes, they feel well again, they can compensate for it and fast again. If that harm is going to the way of the milk, because the milk is for the child and the child here is the priority, you don't fast, but you need to compensate in terms of giving food to poor people. But if, you know, not eating something because you are fasting is just harmful for you, not the milk, then you just have to fast and there's no more compensation for it to the poor people that we talked about before. Thank you so very much. Goodbye and see you again.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, a correct fast. Let's say someone sins through backbiting, lying, lustful sight, cursing, oppression, etc. Is their fast invalid? Well, technically no. Their wajib duty is fulfilled. But wait, some of these sins are major sins. How do we reconcile the two, that their fast is valid at the same time they've committed these, you know, major sins. Are you ready for the answer? Well, if the scholars and jurisprudence consider the fasting of someone who has committed some sins as correct, it is from this consideration that what they meant with this correctness of this fast is from the point of view of make-up fasting. That is, for someone like this, it is not obligatory that after the holy month of Ramadan, he must repeat these fasts as make-up fasting, you know, the qada fasting. But what is meant with the correctness of fasting in traditions is their acceptance by Allah, okay? So see the difference. One is where you just don't have to make up the fast. But when these traditions talk about the invalidity of the fast, it is in terms of its acceptance by Allah. And in many cases, a fast observer may undertake a fast in such a manner that in accordance with the religious decree of a jurisprudent, a faqih, it would not be obligatory upon him to offer a makeup or the qada fast. But it may be that such fast would not have been acceptable by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because of that major sin. So our goal should not be just to make it compliant with the jurisprudential rulings. Rather, our goal should be to make our fasts such that those fasts are accepted by Allah.
Ramadanul Mustabin جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the correctness of fast. And we said that there are really two levels of a fast being correct. The first one is, of course, the jurisprudential rulings, which makes a fast correct. But what we are after is a level of correctness where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accepts our fast. The correct and perfect fast, which Allah, the glorious, the exalted, has made obligatory for the self-perfection and spiritual ascent of fast observers, inevitably must be accompanied with abstinence from all bodily sins. Apart from that, it would be much better if the fast observer, in addition to renunciation of bodily sins, should also practice abstinence from sins of the heart. That is, he should prevent the heart from any other remembrance except Allah's, and should renounce everything except Allah, which is the most superior and esteemed fast. Someone who has truly discovered the reality, virtues, and wisdom of fasting inevitably should abstain from all sort of sins and transgression for the sake of fast's acceptance. Otherwise, on the day of judgment, he would be questioned why his eyes, ears, tongue, and other bodily parts did not observe fasting. And simply quitting eating and drinking, which would relieve him from undertaking make-up fast, of course, we know in this world, it would not make him immune from scrutiny and Allah's punishment on the day of judgment. So, inshallah, let's try to keep fasts the way they should be. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
around the world with reporters.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to mark World Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day is observed annually around the globe on the 3rd of May as a reminder that freedom of the press is a fundamental human right. Israeli forces killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past two decades and haven't been held accountable for their crimes. Currently, 16 Palestinian journalists are being held in Israeli jails, including four under administrative detention. During a press conference, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate demanded an end to Israel's impunity.
Palestinian journalists are subjected to Israeli aggression, including killings and arrests, almost every day, whether while they are covering the news or even inside their workplaces. Journalists are constantly threatened by Israeli forces. Such Israeli attacks and threats amount to war crimes, and we have reported these crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Israeli violence against journalists includes physical and verbal assault, as well as degrading treatment. Observers say the Israeli regime forces aim to keep journalists and mass media away from covering their crimes.
The silence of the international organizations has encouraged Israeli forces to further violate the rights of Palestinian journalists. All international press unions and syndicates must stand by Palestinian journalists and exert pressure on Israel to stop its immoral and illegal practices against journalists.
Israeli forces attacked several Palestinian media offices during the last three wars on the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of 2020, Israeli forces carried out over 200 attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Over the past 4 months, Israeli forces carried out more than 217 violations against Palestinian journalists and media offices throughout the Palestinian territories. The attacks happened despite the protection that journalists enjoy under international law. It's crystal clear that Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists are deliberate and systematic.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
On World Press Freedom Day, journalists demand international protection. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran says substantial progress has been made in several rounds of Vienna talks between Iran and their remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Speaking at an online press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh told reporters the Islamic Republic of Iran wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the nuclear deal.
The negotiators have come up with two drafts so far, but there are still differences that need to be discussed. The Islamic Republic wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the JCPOA. Iran would verify the sanctions removal since those measures have deprived Iran of its JCPOA benefits. The remaining parties engaged in Vienna talks are also concentrating on the way the U.S. could return to the deal.
Regarding the statements by Iran's top negotiator in Vienna, Abbas Araghchi, who suggested that a list of sanctions on individuals and on Iran's energy, auto, financial, insurance and port sectors have been agreed to be lifted, the foreign ministry spokesman said all sanctions under different labels should be lifted.
A red line is that all sanctions reimposed and those imposed under different labels must be lifted. There has been agreement on many issues, but there are also disagreements. Developments are significant and good, but it's slow in some areas.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. Iran, in return, reduced its own commitments as a tit-for-tat by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna to discuss how the U.S. should return to the JCPOA.
The Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must terminate all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The
Yemeni army said it had launched an operation using 4 drones of Qassaf K2 type and 2 ballistic missiles of Badr type against Saudi Arabia, targeting King Khalid Air Base in Asir and other military targets in Najran Airport.
Our operation targeted Saudi airports because they are being used for warplanes to take off and launch airstrikes on the Yemeni people. They are also used to reinforce the Saudi-backed forces in Ma'rib and the rest of the battlefronts. We carry out the operation based on accurate information that reached us from the Saudi depths.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army said this attack came in response to the continued escalation of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its tighter restrictions on fuel imports. He vowed larger attacks if the war is not yet stopped.
The continuation of the Yemenis' attacks deep inside Saudi Arabia confirms that the Yemeni army has developed its military capabilities to inflict further damage to Saudi sites. The Yemeni army aims to protect Yemen's airspace against Saudi airstrikes in conjunction with the continued advancement toward the city of Ma'rib.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015. The Saudi war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and the children, and brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. Experts say the Yemeni army's retaliatory attacks sent this clear message to Saudi Arabia and its allies that the more attacks against Yemeni civilians and tighter blockade, the more painful attacks against Saudi facilities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
U.S. President Joe Biden called North Korea a threat in his first address to Congress as his administration announced it had completed a long-awaited review of American policy toward Pyongyang. Biden's remarks were soon followed up by his Director of National Intelligence.
For its part, North Korea may take aggressive and potentially destabilizing actions to reshape its security environment and will seek to drive wedges between the United States and its allies. These efforts could include the resumption of nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missile testing in the future.
North Korea reacted harshly to the comments, with a leading official saying the U.S. would face a very grave situation if it did not end its hostile policy. In South Korea, Washington's rhetoric was met with disappointment.
The Biden administration has said it will pursue resolute deterrence while the North Korean nuclear issue is a threat to the world peace. So for Pyongyang, Washington's hostile policy seems only a pretext to strengthen itself.
North Korea has been subject to U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions, which Pyongyang would like to be suspended. There are also other moves the U.S. could make to get talks going.
Since there is a large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in August that North Korea sees as a hostile, an announcement suspending these drills would help create an atmosphere of dialogue.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is set to meet with President Biden at the Oval Office later this month, where he's likely to press for engagement between the U.S. and North Korea. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Sunday that Washington's policies not aimed at hostility, but solutions. The question is whether those solutions involve U.S. incentives that will bring Pyongyang to the negotiating table. Frank Smith, Seoul.
U.S.-led NATO forces are spending their last months in Afghanistan, and this is good news for most American soldiers. They will finally witness the end of their mission in a country historically known as the Graveyard of Empires. This is why the U.S. war in Afghanistan has so far claimed the lives of 90,000 U.S.-led NATO troops and Afghan armed forces. However, military top brass in Kabul insists that there is zero chance of victory for the Taliban through militarism, despite the start of foreign troops withdrawal from Afghanistan on Saturday. This is because the Afghan government is now strong enough to counter terrorist groups on its own and also enjoys high popularity among locals.
بیرون شدن.
The withdrawal of foreign forces has practically started. They will hand over their military bases and some of their military hardware to Afghan forces by the end of this week. We are strong enough and we can safeguard the nation on our own.
In the meantime, the Taliban have not welcomed the troop pullout by Washington, saying the U.S. had agreed to withdraw all foreign military forces from Afghanistan by the May 1st. This has paved the way for the Taliban to legitimize their acts of violence beyond May the 1st. Under such circumstances, civilians will once again turn into the main victims of violence in the war-weary country.
Foreign troops must leave our country, and the Taliban are also expected to respect people's demand, that is the silence of guns. There must be no war among ourselves after the withdrawal of foreign troops, and the Taliban need to realize this reality.
The Taliban are seeking excuses to keep saying no to peace. The postponement of the U.S. military withdrawal has now turned into a good pretext for them to wage more war and kill more defenseless civilians.
The Taliban have vowed to take any possible action because of what they call the violation of the Doha Agreement by Washington, that is the delay in the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan. However, what remains to be a bitter truth is that not many players seem to be ready to truly help Afghans see a day when there is no war and insecurity in their wounded homeland. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Pakistan's federal parliament in Islamabad. The lower house of the parliament is preparing to resume a debate on whether or not to expel French ambassador over repeated incident of blasphemy in France against Islam's last prophet Muhammad. However, days before the resumption of parliamentary debate here, the European Union Parliament has come up with what appears to be counter-resolution to pressurize Islamabad to prevent the expulsion of French envoy from Pakistan. The European Parliament has decided to review with Pakistan our trade agreement known as Generalized System of Preferential Plus or GPS Plus over what it calls a rising anti-French sentiments and mistreatment of minorities under blasphemy laws in Pakistan. Under this trade deal, Islamabad gets an estimated annual additional $1.5 billion trade benefits, which are far less than the economic losses Pakistan suffers almost every year because of mass unrest linked with Islamophobia in France. The frequent incidents of blasphemy in France has led to mass unrest across Pakistan.
The European Union is putting pressure on Pakistan, and they want them to weigh and to see whether this decision of expelling the French ambassador from Pakistan, will the government of Pakistan, will the people of Pakistan pay the price? Are they ready?
European Union's concerns go much beyond possibly expelling French ambassador.
Prime Minister Khan has crossed the Rubicon. EU policy towards countries that enable Islamic extremism must be resolute. Withdraw Pakistan's GSP Plus status now.
In an official reaction, Islamabad expressed disappointment with the European Union, pointing out that it reflects a lack of understanding in the context of blasphemy and associated religious sensitivities in Pakistan and elsewhere in the Muslim world.
None of the convict of the blasphemy law was ever executed in Pakistan after successful governments and superior judiciary allegedly buckled under pressure to set convicts free and led them to migrate and settle in Europe. This has led to lynching of 75 under trial prisoners and suspects amid reports of misuse of blasphemy law in isolated cases since 1987 onwards. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Every year on the 1st of May, protesters fill the streets of cities around the world, marching on what's known as May Day or International Labour Day. Demonstrators usually consist of various groups supporting a wide variety of causes. Yet this year, in the UK, activists joined more than 40 protests throughout the country, centred around one thing: opposition to the controversial police crime sentencing and courts bill, with the main focus of dissent coming from London.
Most notable to me
with the fact that the police, under the powers of this legislation, and this is new, will be able to say that this demonstration, for example, through the noise that it's causing, is causing a nuisance. And if that nuisance is serious, they will be able to arrest people, fine them up to £10,000, and imprison them.
What will be next? That bill come through, that's just going to be one of a whole range of new policies and things that will just silence any form of criticism.
The new legislation pending in Parliament could allow police to impose conditions on protests, including start and finish times and the imposition of noise limits. This bill would also allow the police to prematurely end a protest if it caused serious annoyance to the surrounding community, organisation and businesses, which demonstrators argue is the whole point of protests.
This bill makes it impossible to have any kind of strike, any kind of picket that has any effect.
Thousands upon thousands have turned up here to defend the right to protest, something Brits up and down the country feel is under threat.
More than 600 civil society and protest groups have called for the government to drop the legislation, and the mobilisation of protesters on the streets has already forced a planned passage through Parliament to be delayed. Yet only time will tell whether the huge protests up and down the country has successfully defeated the anti-protest bill. Ahmed Gabello, London.
Over 300 marches took place and hundreds of thousands demonstrated all over France for May Day to claim more rights for the workers. The COVID crisis is hitting the French economy very hard, but not everybody is equally affected by the crisis. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well despite the COVID crisis, but they prefer to pay benefits for their shareholders rather than improving working conditions. So the main concern for French trade unions now is to save jobs and to stop companies from firing workers.
The big companies have received a lot of public money without any social ecological conditions to fulfill. Public money cannot be given to companies that fire workers continue to pollute, companies that relocate. So we demand that strict conditions be imposed before giving public aid to companies.
The COVID crisis has highlighted the importance of ordinary workers for the French economy. Garbage collectors, railway workers, supermarket cashiers, mostly women, home care workers, delivery drivers, and, of course, hospital workers. Their work is now widely considered as essential to keep the economy running. French President Macron promised to re-evaluate their jobs.
Macron just promised a bonus that is not even obligatory. He does not want to increase the minimum wage, and that is for us the reference. The government thinks that the higher salaries will lead to less jobs, but for us it's the opposite. Higher salaries will boost the economy and create more jobs.
The demonstration in Paris was closely monitored by the police. Clashes broke out when more radical demonstrators threw stones and bottles to the police officers who charged and fired tear gas. There is a lot of frustration among working people. Many blame the French authorities for its disengagement from the public sector, especially the hospital sector, which is crucial to get the coronavirus under control.
The anger is still growing among working people. Those at the front line against the coronavirus demand a permanent upgrade of their jobs, salary and working conditions. But the French government, till now, has only paid them bonuses once. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Across the world, and even in the United States, people took to the streets to celebrate International Workers' Day, May 1st. The turbulent 2020 saw America reverse 50 years of political apathy. Marchers say the time for the lower and middle classes to unite is now, because the 1% is already united and profiting from soaring post-lockdown inequalities every day.
I do think that there will be a rise of leftism because, you know, when we're able to win certain gains through struggles like Black Lives Matter has, you know, getting Chauvin convicted, that shows the power of the working class to fight for more. And, this is just the beginning of the mobilizations I think we're going to see.
Given the status of Chicago as the ideological center of neoliberal thought, many may be surprised that the epicenter of the very first May Day ever was Chicago. In 1886, 100,000 Chicagoan leftists peacefully took to the streets to demand an 8-hour working day and were met with deadly police violence. The U.S. government failed to replace May Day with an attempt at Law and Order Day, but by 1890, the first International Workers' Day for Unity and Solidarity was declared. The holiday is celebrated in scores of countries and often called Labor Day, but most English-language countries celebrate their own Labor Day in autumn.
This is a day where we're connecting lots of struggles that are important to the workers' movement, right? Immigrants' rights, the defunding the police, the Black Lives Matter explosion of the last year, right? The uprising has shown that there is really a fighting mood within the U.S., the workers' movement in general.
Many 19th-century struggles are still being fought today, such as against the privileges and parasitism created by monarchies. New U.S. President Joe Biden just rejected a $15 per hour minimum wage, even though wages haven't been hiked since 2009, and non-governmental estimates of inflation are 10% annually. Businesses like Amazon are dubbed innovation heroes in the mainstream media, yet are notorious for grueling working conditions. Many marching on May Day also oppose Western liberal democracy, which is often accused of creating and protecting a new aristocracy on the backs of the average worker. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah. Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah, in which we're going to talk about famous Quran reciters. Today, we'll be talking about an Iranian reciter who a lot of you probably know him. He is Brother Mohsen Haj Hassani Kargar, the late martyr Mohsen Haj Hassani Kargar. This great reciter of the Quran was born in Mashhad in 1988. Haven't you noticed that many of the greatest Iranian reciters are from Mashhad? It's interesting. Sheikh Shahat Anwar, when he was asked, where is the center of Quran recitation after Egypt, he said Mashhad. He didn't say Iran. He directly said Mashhad is the center of the Quran. And we see that many great reciters are educated and trained in this city. We have many great teachers as well, teachers of the Quran in this city, such as Brother Murtaza Sadat Fatemi, or Brother Hashim Rouhani, and many other reciters, such as Brother Muhammad Jawad Panahi and other reciters. Okay, so this martyr, Mohsen Haj Hassani Kargar, he became interested in the Holy Quran when he was just 3 years old. At first, his teacher of the Quran was his brother, Mustafa Haj Hassani Kargar. He followed the style of Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar, like many Iranians do. There are a lot of young reciters who are the followers of the style of Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar. Brother Mohsen Haj Hassani Kargar was one of the most talented and skilled reciters in following the style of Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar. This great reciter was able to place first in the competition held in Malaysia in the year 2015. It's very difficult to win this competition. It was probably 5 or 6 or more years that no Iranian had been able to place first in the Malaysian competitions. But Brother Mohsen Haj Hassani Kargar